Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
New York Community Bank brings in the big guns. Motley Fool Money starts now. Welcome to Motley Fool Money. I'm Deidre Woolard, here with Motley Fool analyst Bill Barker. Bill, how's your Thursday going so far?
Going great. Thanks for asking.
Well, it's quite a Thursday for New York Community Bank Corp. You know, it was just about a year ago, Signature Bank collapsed. Now the company that acquired part of those assets, New York Community Bank Corp, they almost had their own near collapse. Trading paused yesterday, but then the lifeline. Company received $1 billion in equity investment from a group that includes our former U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, his Liberty Strategic Capital, Hudson Bay, and some other groups. Now, this solves a little bit of the immediate problem, but what was happening at this bank to bring about this moment?
Well, it was disclosing that its loan portfolio didn't look as good as investors thought it was. It's got a couple concentrations in some areas of difficulty, multifamily and in the rent-controlled space and commercial real estate. And I think commercial real estate is gotten a lot more publicity for the problems that happen when an office building can't be filled with tenants. It's rather easy to see that the rents aren't coming in, and the new tenants that you'd like to have come in and fill empty space either aren't around because offices aren't really filling up seats the way they had, or at the very least are in a position to demand some pretty good prices compared to the old days. And then the rent-controlled multifamily units, you've got the controlled rent coming in, and that's capped at about 3% annual increases, and the upkeep and the loan servicing for these are much higher. So whereas the equation was perfectly viable in a low inflation and low interest rate era, when both of those change, but the rent that you can have coming in does not change by regulation, the math equation is working against you. And it's been working against this bank of late.
Yeah, absolutely. It was interesting that looking at those loans, because about 44% of them are multifamily in total, only about 12% commercial real estate. So that's good. You know, they tried to fix their problems on their own over the past month. It's been in and out of the news. They put in the former CEO of Flagstar, which was bought by New York Community Bank, and he was there for about a month. Now you've got this whole new cadre of people. So there's going to be four new members of the bank's board of directors, including Steve Mnuchin, Joseph Otting, who worked with Mnuchin, previously the comptroller of the currency, former CEO of One West Bank. He's going to be the new CEO. So you've got this massive turnaround. You've got these people coming in. You know, Mnuchin, he was on CNBC, and in the press release, he said the company can be a $100 billion national bank. That seems really ambitious to me, given the fact that they've just had this month of incredible turmoil. They lost 7% of their deposits. What do you think he's seeing here?
Well, I don't know exactly what the $100 billion refers to, whether that's talking about loans outstanding. Sure, it can get there just by continuing to loan a bit more money. But in terms of equity value, I'm sure that isn't the equation that we're talking about, because it's a long way from there. Mnuchin's got a track record of working with banks in receivership and helping to turn them around, investing intelligently in distressed banks. So I think that his name, which is already known to many people much more so than the names that also are coming in, but have experience as well. So I think that that you know he's the featured name. He brings a lot of, I think, calm to the equation. Not only Mnuchin and his team of equity investors, but other private equity entities that are making similar investments have been able to look at the books and evaluate whether this is going to survive as a going concern. And they like what they see at the price that has become available, which is very, very cheap compared to what it used to be. So if, as long as you can establish credibility that this is going to be a going concern and you don't have a run of depositors fleeing the bank, then it's probably going to work out. So it's the perception of stability, which is maybe the most important thing. And Mnuchin provides a lot of that.
Yeah, he does. And he talked a little bit about that this situation is different than the situation we found ourselves in last year. This is a regional bank with a lot of branches. But there is that concern about the regionals now. You know, we're sort of looping back on last year. Doesn't seem like this is something where you have an issue of contagion or, you know, or people feeling upset and maybe a bank run on regionals, but it's not out of the question. Does that make you nervous at all?
I have been nervous about what appears to be a potentially huge problem, which is a lot of loans outstanding for commercial real estate to buildings that are not going to be able to fill up the office space that has either already been abandoned or is in the process of being abandoned, or if not abandoned, downscaled. So the relative lack of situations like this that has happened so far seems like good news, but it doesn't mean that they're not going to happen. And of course, there are always a few banks that are going under. Out of the thousands of banks that we have in this country, most other countries don't have nearly as many independently operated banks as we do. There are going to be failures, and so if you can name the failures, that's probably a reasonably good sign because of the thousands that are left.
Yeah. And this bank falls in it's not in the too big to fail category, but it certainly is in the bigger than a lot of the other small failures that probably don't make headlines.
It's of concern, the fact that they were able to raise $1 billion relatively quickly from some high profile and individuals with track records in this area is of comfort for this one bank. At this particular price, to say that it may be worth the equity may be worth two or three times what the private equity has gotten in on, might be the case. I'm just picking those numbers out, but it doesn't mean that we're not going to see commercial real estate at the very least, and also rent-controlled multifamily crop up in some other place. And I think that you should expect some more reserves and some more write-downs of goodwill on regional bank balance sheets over the coming year.
I'm going to take us in a totally different direction now, because I want to talk a little bit about retail. And it's been such a weird, I studied the earnings results. It's such a weird mixed bag for retail. You know, we had Target reporting earlier this week. Dylan Nassett talked a bit about that yesterday. We had Nordstrom results weren't great there. But one thing that's surprising me is some of these mall staples, these kind of almost, we forget that they're still there, companies are doing well. Abercrombie & Fitch is doing incredibly well. So they reported a really strong fourth quarter and year. Comparable sales up 16%. The strength of the Abercrombie brand versus the Hollister brand, very strong. This stock has done incredibly. One of the things that I think surprises people is, oh my goodness, it has outperformed NVIDIA in terms of stock run-up. What is happening here? And if you're an investor, what might you be thinking?
If you're an investor, I think you're thanking your lucky stars that because I take a look at the chart on this. It's just straight up, nearly vertical over the last 9, 12 months. And you look at the previous 25 years, and it was going nowhere. and it just would have a decent run with a, you know, hit the fashion sense with the right things at the right time for a little bit. And then like everybody else, it misses, and it just goes back and forth, up and down over the decades of just not treading water. Just, it's like a heartbeat, you know, where there's a, if you're watching your favorite medical show on TV and you see the heart monitor and it goes beep, beep, beep with regularity, nothing starts going too high up or down while things are stable. This has just taken off, and I think there is relatively little expectation that it can maintain anything approaching the stock returns that it's achieved in the last 12 months, because it's, I don't know, it's about 10% bigger in terms of sales than it was pre-pandemic.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it's also, you think about Abercrombie and you think about the old days of the Abercrombie with those sort of where you could smell the male cologne with wafting out of the store. It's very different now. And, you know, WSJ had an interesting article about this, about company reaping the rewards of taking adult women seriously. And it started me thinking about if maybe these brands that people loved as teenagers are now sort of adopting, you know, they're coming back for the grownups. It's an odd time for these to have a resurgence.
They've achieved some inroads online, but so has everybody else. Yeah. And I think, of course, they were priced very low after a number of misses going into, you know, a year ago. So it had a very, very easy act to follow in terms of increasing sales and in terms of actually converting sales into real profits. So it has achieved both of those things of late. But, you know, to anticipate that a 300% stock move is going to be repeated even over the next decade, I would say, is to expect that this company does something that it hasn't done in the past and that its brethren have also not been able to do. It's not a compounding story in you know, fashion retail for the most part. It's hits and misses, ups and downs, a little bit of dividend, but not a thing which you can bank on 20% type growth compounding year over year.
Yeah, yeah. You would have to sell a lot of comfortable jeans. We also had American Eagle reporting today. Good for them too. Record fourth quarter revenue up 12%. Thing I found interesting was that post-pandemic, they made this investment in logistics, and now they're writing it down for about $94 billion. This almost seems to me like what happened with Shopify, right? Where you had the company go in on logistics and then decide like, wait, this is more challenging than you think. So logistics seems to be a lot harder for anybody without the name Amazon.
Well, Amazon XPO has achieved a lot in its spinoff in logistics, GXO. There's a lot to achieve in that space when you get it right, but it takes a lot of technology expertise, a lot of upfront spending, and then ongoing spending on tech. And so I understand entities that look at their costs for logistics and think, well, if we can just recapture that, and then once we build a system that works for us, you know, start stealing clients and expanding it, they see the pot of gold that might be available if they get it right. But it's not easy. And you've got reverse logistics, where people are, you know, buying their things online, trying them on, and saying, nope, don't want it, and put it back in the box. And what happens to the box after that, you know, goes back into some central reservoir of other boxes. And then you've got to figure out how to redistribute them, or, you know, what can be resold. And there's much, much more that goes into all of that than American Eagle anticipated, or others that have also tried it.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And of course, now they're going to focus on the brands, which makes sense. And, you know, thinking about both Abercrombie and American Eagle, one of the things that, you know, it's not just the capturing the nostalgia from younger people who are now growing up. But I think there's also something happening larger in retail, which is this idea of we went through the pandemic, we went through that athleisure phase, we saw Lululemon and things like that. Now we sort of seem to be in this other phase, which is, I would call it somewhere between the business suit and the sweatpants, where you've got people that we're out, we're past the pandemic, we're not just in our houses, but we're not fully like, we're not fully into formal wear. It seems like that is an area that these retailers and maybe some others should be focusing on.
Well, if you were to scour the universe for people whose opinions you should listen to on fashion, I would come in either dead last or pretty close. So let me just turn that back to you. What do you think is going on here that investors could take advantage of, or that companies can get right today that they haven't gotten right before today?
Well, I think with Abercrombie, they announced wedding clothes and wedding accessories. And some of that is, weddings are such a big business now. Bachelorette parties are such a big business. I think that they're doing the right thing in catering to, for trying to figure out what the new generation wants and moving with some of those trends. I mean, it's kind of great to see jeans coming back, because for a while there, it was all leggings all the time.
There is a cover of the New York Times Magazine this week, which has some enormous pair of pants on it. And that I guess some wide pants are back in style, or maybe I misread it. Maybe they've completely died. I don't know. As I say, I'm the last person to talk to about fashion and what might be happening or what might happen next. Things come and go. I would be surprised to hear that blue jeans suffered any near death and are now back. I hadn't seen that. I think it's maybe that's news that I hadn't been following. So I think all these entities will be in the right place at the right time for a short period of time, and will have a hard time staying in the center of what is demanded in fashion for very long.
That is true. It's a tough game to invest in. Thanks for talking with me today, Bill.
Thank you.
Ricky Mulvey with Motley Fool Money here. So I work from home most of the time when I'm working on the show, but sometimes I get a little cooped up and there's a coffee shop in my neighborhood where I'll go to prep, do some admin. I try not to take Zoom calls because that's not good for anyone involved when you're at a coffee shop. Anyway, I don't want people spying on my browsing activity when I'm on a public network. So the solution is a virtual private network, and NordVPN offers a reliable way to protect your personal information and location from bad actors. What I really like about NordVPN is that you get more than just a VPN. You get protected from malware, web trackers, ads, and other internet threats, alongside a dark web monitor that gives you instant alerts if any of your accounts are compromised. You buy the subscription, download the app, and connect to a VPN server. Nord lets you connect up to 6 devices so you can protect your family too. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/motleyfool to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan, plus 4 extra months, plus an extra gift for free. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee.
Today in Travel Week, we move from air to sea. Mary Long caught up with Fool contributor Matt Frankel to check in on cruise line companies and see which, if any, are sure bets for investors.
So I hear that you go on cruises regularly. Maybe first let's start there. Any highlights from a recent trip?
We actually just got back a couple weeks ago. We did a 6-night trip that went to Mexico, Grand Cayman, and Jamaica. And we took my kids. It was a great time.
So if you're going on multiple, are you like loyal to a specific brand? Are you choosing a cruise for the destinations? What's kind of going through your thought process as you're selecting a cruise for vacation?
Both. I don't want to say I'm loyal to one brand. We generally cruise on Carnival the most just because I have 2 little kids and they have a lot of stuff for kids to do on those ships. They love the kids camps and things like that. I've also done Royal Caribbean. I've done Virgin Voyages, which was a really fun experience. And my kids are begging me to do a Disney cruise. So maybe at some point I'll do one of those.
So you mentioned Carnival and Royal Caribbean. There are three big players that are publicly traded companies in this industry, one of which is Carnival. That's the largest cruise company in the world. It's got over 100 ships across its family of brands. Then there's Royal Caribbean, which has a bit of a reputation perhaps as being an industry innovator. And then there's also Norwegian, which we haven't mentioned. Out of the three, this is the smallest, and it bills itself as offering, quote, the most nimble and contemporary fleets in the industry. So talked about how you, Matt, as a person, maybe like choose between different cruises. But if we put the investor hat on, how do you differentiate each of these three companies from each other?
When you look at them just from a fundamental standpoint, they're not that different. They're in the same ballpark when it comes to how much debt they have relative to their capitalization. They're all in the same ballpark when it comes to things like gross margin, revenue growth over the past year. They're all within, you know, 10 percentage points of each other. And just the trends we saw during COVID just showed how similar all of these businesses are. The products are very different. Just having been on Carnival and Royal Caribbean, I can tell you the product is very different. But as far as just from a fundamental standpoint, there's not that much difference between them.
So it's unsurprising, but interesting to me that there's not much difference between in the fundamentals of these companies. If you look at the stock charts for the three of these since 2019, there's not too much to brag about. It's not really a pretty picture here. But Royal Caribbean has handily outperformed Norwegian and Carnival, Royal Caribbean being up 3%, while its competitors are down 72% and 66% respectively. Again, there's not a lot to brag about here, but that gap between Royal Caribbean and Carnival and Norwegian is striking to me. What is there something happening at Royal Caribbean that's maybe worth paying attention to?
Yeah, there's, that's a whole topic for a whole other podcast, but let's just break down the key points here. So number one, Royal Caribbean's debt situation is the best of the three. And to just put in perspective how much debt these companies have, Royal Caribbean is a $31 billion market cap company with $21.5 billion worth of long-term debt. That's the best of the three by a significant margin when it comes to the debt ratio. All of these companies were losing money hand over fist during COVID. Royal Caribbean, again, the best of the three, 10 consecutive quarters of operating losses during COVID. So all these companies, when you say they're, Carnival and Norwegian are down, a lot of the reason is they had to dilute shareholders by raising some capital and things like that. Not necessarily, there wasn't all debt that they raised. Some of it was equity capital. But Royal Caribbean in particular, they do some things just better. I'll just give one example from their marketing standpoint. If you go on any of the other cruise lines like Carnival, Norwegian, and take a short cruise, which a lot of people who aren't sure if they're going to like it will do like a 3 or 4 night cruise. If you go on Carnival, you're going to be on one of the older ships. That's what they use for their weekend cruises, things like that. Royal Caribbean has built some of their biggest, newest ships and exclusively uses them for 3 and 4 night sailings. There's no way to experience everything on one of those ships in even a week, let alone a 3 or 4 night sailing. So the idea is, wow, this is spectacular. Now I've tried it for 3 nights. I love cruising. I'm gonna book a longer cruise. Or I didn't get to try everything I wanted to on the ship in 3 nights, but it's easy for me to get away for a long weekend. So I'm going to book another one in a few months on the same ship and try everything else. It's just the genius marketing moves like that. They're better at monetizing their assets. If, let's say, you book a room that doesn't have a window, you have an inside room, you know, to save money, and you want an upgrade. Carnival's upgrade process is clunky at best. They'll randomly target you, say, do you want a balcony room, pay this much, but it's very random and very disjointed. Royal Caribbean has a much better system of that. They actively try to upsell you to different rooms. You know, if you book a year in advance, you'll get emails inviting you to upgrade your room. They have their own private island that's the best in the business by far. And they monetize the heck out of it. They have overwater cabanas there that looks like something out of Tahiti that they sell for $3,500 for the day, and they sell out every cruise. So they're better at monetizing. Just only 70% of Royal Caribbean's revenue comes from their cruise fare, which is a cool stat. So they have 30% of their revenue, which is a big number, from just spending while you're already on the ship.
You know, you talked about the debt situation at each of these companies. COVID obviously completely changed and really hurt this industry. But was this massive amount of debt that each of these companies are holding now. Was that also a reality before COVID? Has this like always been an industry-wide issue or just something that you've got to factor in? Or is this primarily a post-COVID problem?
Yeah, these are definitely capital-intensive businesses. We were talking before recording how the average cruise ship burns 80,000 gallons of fuel a day. You have to pay for that before you sail. The cost of the cruise ship themselves, Royal Caribbean's brand new ship, the Icon of the Seas, the biggest ship in the world, cost $2 billion to build. They just ordered another identical ship for delivery next year. These are very expensive. At the end of the day, they're vehicles. They're not hotels. They're vehicles. So they're very expensive ones. The debt situation has been a thing for a long time. Carnival's debt situation got the worst of the three during COVID. They added about $6.5 billion of new debt. But in 2019, they already had $22 billion in long-term debt. So it's not a new thing. Royal Caribbean's debt, despite the misconception about debt, you know, pouring on during COVID, went up by less than 10% during COVID. Went from $18 billion to $19.7 billion during the pandemic. That's 2019 to 2023. So this is a reality of the business. And when they were in better financial shape before the pandemic, they had access to better financing terms generally, and the interest rate environment was lower. I mean, just in simple terms, $20 billion at 5% interest and $20 billion in debt at 10% interest are two totally different things on your balance sheet. So that plays into it as well. But yeah, the debt in this business is a thing. And Carnival just refinanced to some more affordable debt. So that's really the name of the game, is to make your debt as affordable as possible. Because if you can borrow money and generate returns on that borrowed money that are in excess of your interest rates, it's a good financial move. Yes, you can run a cruise line with no debt, but it would be like buying a house with no mortgage. You're leaving a lot, you're robbing yourself of that opportunity cost.
Are you seeing any notable differences or like particularly impressive strategies in how one particular company is paying off that debt post-COVID?
I'd say Carnival. They're being the most aggressive at getting their debt under control. And to be fair, they need to. In the first half of 2023, they got rid of $1.4 billion worth of debt. In the middle of 2023, they announced a bunch of refinancing transactions. They were paying up to 10.5% interest on a lot of their debt. Obviously, that's not ideal. That's a tough hurdle to overcome when it comes to returns on capital. They saved $120 million by refinancing just a little over $1 billion of debt. They're not just trying to retire debt, because obviously they need to invest money in the business. They can't just, if they make, you know, $2 billion of profit this year, they can't just put that toward debt reduction. They need to use some of it to keep their fleet modern, order new ships, keep their business competitive. So the strategy seems to be reduce the cost of your debt as opposed to just totally get rid of it.
You made the point earlier that cruise ships are vehicles, not hotels. And I want to hone in on that because if I look at Carnival's balance sheet, right? Total assets at the end of 2023, $49 billion. Of that, $40 billion are property and equipment. So a huge chunk of their assets are what I'm assuming they're cruise ships. But when I don't know anyone who owns a cruise ship, but from a personal finance perspective, I know that as a general rule, vehicles depreciate in value. So is there an asterisk next to this massive amount of assets that these cruise lines are carrying? Like, how should we think about this as investors? Are these really as meaningful as real estate assets might be, or is there something else there?
Well, yes. So they do depreciate over time. Cruise lines absolutely get a tax benefit from that depreciation. Generally speaking, just boats in general, if you go and buy a boat, it has a longer lifespan than a car. It's not unusual to buy a 20-year-old boat that's in perfectly good condition, for example. So with cruise ships, the rule of thumb is they usually are given a useful lifespan of about 30 years. At which point they're estimated to be worth about 15% of their original value. And the cruise line writes off a proportional amount of that as depreciation every year. So they're getting a nice benefit. It's just like how a real estate investment trust gets a lot of tax benefit from depreciation. So do cruise lines. So they do depreciate, but it's not as fast as you might think. And they generally, you know, they could sell the cruise ship to like a lower end cruise line or something like that, or sell it for parts or things like that at the end. So, and it's a tax benefit along the way.
We're recording this a couple days after Norwegian reported its 2023 results. The company was profitable for the first time since 2019. Investors seemingly saw smooth sailing ahead. Shares for Norwegian were up, as were they were for Carnival and for Royal Caribbean as well. What say you? You're a cruiser yourself, but are you riding the wave as an investor? Are you riding the wave of Norwegian and these other cruise companies, or are you just going to sit tight and stay a passenger for now?
I'm generally on the sidelines. When it comes to cruise lines, airlines, any of these, my general rule is that a great product is not always a great business, and that's especially the case here. The businesses are doing fantastic right now. Norwegian is expecting is getting three new ships this year. That's the most ever in a single year. Royal Caribbean just reported that they had their five best booking weeks ever in their history during the fourth quarter of 2023. All five of the best weeks ever. If you believe that this demand is going to stay forever, these are great investments. That's a big if. This is a very cyclical business. And what's really impressing people is they're doing this at a time when the economy is like, it's a lot of uncertainty in the economy. So if you think that the demand's going to stay, these are great businesses. Their valuations are not that high. Just to name a couple, Royal Caribbean trades for about 13 times forward earnings, which is not an expensive stock. But you're assuming that this record high level of demand is going to stay forever. So that's kind of my caution right here.
As always, people on the program may have interest in the stocks they talk about, and the Motley Fool may have formal recommendations for or against. So don't buy or sell stocks based solely on what you hear. I'm Deidre Woolard. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks again.